Welcome to SCOTUS Cast, the First Amendment in a Funeral Edition. Thank you for tuning in. On October 6, 2010, the Supreme Court heard oral argument in Snyder v. Phelps. The case presents several questions about the application of various aspects of First Amendment doctrine to protesters at a military funeral. To discuss the case, we have Professor Calvin R. Massey, who is a professor at the University of California, Hastings College of the Law. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Professor Massey.
Hello, this is Calvin Massey, and I'm here to talk about Snyder against Phelps, a case argued in October before the Supreme Court and now pending before the court. This case presents another facet in the conflict between imposition of tort liability for personal injuries caused by speech and the First Amendment's guarantee of freedom of speech. Marine Lance Corporal Matthew Snyder was killed in action in Iraq, and his grieving parents chose St. John's Roman Catholic Church in Westminster, Maryland, as the site of his funeral. 2 days before the funeral, the Westboro Baptist Church of Topeka, Kansas, announced their intent to protest the funeral. The Westboro Church was founded over 50 years ago by Fred Phelps, who remains as its minister. Most of its 60 or 70 members are related to Phelps. The Westboro Church has become known for its belief that God punishes America for its tolerance of homosexuality by the death of American servicemen. To dramatize that belief, members of the Westboro Church picket military funerals. At Corporal Snyder's funeral, they carried signs reading, "God hates fags, Semper Fi fags, Pope in hell, God hates the USA, thank God for 9/11, priests rape boys, thank God for dead soldiers, and God hates you." None of those signs were visible to funeral attendees, including Albert Snyder, Matthew's father. After the funeral, the Phelpses posted on their publicly available website an article styled by Phelps as an epic entitled "The Burden of Marine Lance Corporal Matthew Snyder." That posting accused Albert and Julia Snyder, the divorced parents of Matthew, of teaching their son that God is a liar, to defy his creator, to condone divorce and adultery, and of raising him for the devil. The post declared that God intended Matthew to die and excoriated the, quote, "whorehouse called St. John Catholic Church, where Matthew fulfilled his calling." Albert Snyder saw the signs when he viewed television news coverage of his son's funeral. He later encountered and read the Phelps' web posting when he conducted an internet search for his son's name. Snyder sued the Phelps' in federal court on a variety of tort claims. The jury returned a verdict for Snyder on his claims of intentional infliction of emotional distress and invasion of privacy, awarding compensatory and punitive damages of nearly $11 million, reduced after post-trial motions to $5 million. The Fourth Circuit reversed for two reasons. First, the signs and the web posting were, quote, "statements on matters of public concern that did not contain a provably false factual connotation." Second, they were statements employing loose, figurative, or hyperbolic language, and thus entitled to First Amendment protection, to ensure that public debate will not suffer for lack of imaginative expression or the rhetorical hyperbole which has traditionally added much to the discourse of our nation. In the name of freedom of speech, ever since New York Times against Sullivan, the Supreme Court has begun to fashion limits on tort liability that stems from speech. In Sullivan, the court held that liability for defamation of a public official could only occur if the false statement of fact had been uttered with knowledge of its falsity or with reckless disregard for its truth or falsity. Though a bit of a misnomer, that standard of culpability is termed actual malice. Over time, the Sullivan rule has been extended to public figures, and the court has recognized a difference between speech on matters of public concern and commentary on purely private matters by extending greater protection for speech that touches on subjects of public concern. Phelps relies on Hustler magazine against Falwell, in which the Supreme Court held that liability for intentional infliction of emotional distress could not be based upon a cruel parody of Jerry Falwell, a public figure, unless it could be shown that the speech was uttered with actual malice. Because parody is never offered as a literal statement of fact, it is, as a practical matter, wholly insulated from liability by this rule. The Phelpses argue that their signs and web posting contain similar rhetorical hyperbole and so are categorically immunized from liability. The Phelpses also contend that their commentaries are statements of opinion on matters of public concern, homosexuality, the state of American morality, and clergy abuse, and thus is insulated from liability unless those statements contain a provably false factual connotation. Snyder argues that the actual malice standard used in the Falwell case applied only to a public figure, and that a lesser degree of culpability is sufficient to support liability in the context of speech that is intended to inflict emotional injury on a private figure. Although Snyder argues that the Phelps' speech was not of public concern, his backup contention is that there is no categorical immunity for speech of public concern. Speech that targets a private figure, even when of public concern, should not be protected, argues Snyder, when there is little, if any, connection between the private figure and the issues of public concern. Commentary on America's morality, the Catholic Church, or homosexuality has little connection, according to Snyder, to his son's funeral or the way in which he raised Matthew. With respect to his invasion of privacy claim, Snyder argues that there should be no constitutional protection for speech that invades a substantial privacy interest when the plaintiff is, in effect, held captive to that invasion. The Phelpses argue the facts, contending that the Snyder funeral was publicized and thus not private, and that in any case, their picketing was so far removed from the church that it could not constitute an invasion of privacy. The web posting, they say, did not thrust itself involuntarily into Snyder's home, but arrived there because Snyder chose to view it. At oral argument, questions or comments from Justices Kennedy, Ginsburg, Breyer, and Alito suggested that they might regard Snyder as a private figure. That seems to me to be a very likely conclusion on the part of a majority of the court. The court did seem to have more of a problem with characterizing the Phelps' speech as of public concern, or instead, a merely pointed private attack. Justices Kennedy and Sotomayor appealed for help in drawing a line where the speech is susceptible of either characterization. Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Scalia seemed to think that some of the signs were of public concern, but others were not. Justice Ginsburg wondered if the pointed nature of this speech was necessary to convey the broader social and political message. Justice Alito echoed Justice Ginsburg's concern on that point. At least some of the Phelps' commentary is of public concern, in my opinion, albeit quite raw and offensive. But offensive speech may not be punished simply because it is offensive. The court has several options with this case. It could hold that speech on matters of public concern is categorically protected unless it contains a deliberate or reckless falsehood. It could hold that speech that is intended to inflict emotional injury on a private figure and actually does so is never constitutionally protected, whether or not of public concern. Or the court could hold that speech of public concern is not protected when it is intended to inflict emotional distress upon a private figure, actually does so, and there is no reasonable connection between the public issues raised by that speech and the target of the speech. Finally, it could also declare that such speech enjoys no constitutional protection when it is not of public concern and targets a private figure. The first option has some support in prior cases involving defamation, but this case is not about the truth or falsity of the speech, so the actual malice standard is the wrong tool to use. The last option, almost but not quite, tracks the conclusions the court has reached in defamation cases, but would withdraw a bit more speech from constitutional protection on the theory that the constitutional interest in protecting robust, unfettered public debate is not implicated when the speech is purely about private matters. The problem with the second option is that it undervalues the interest in uninhibited public discourse. So that leaves the third option. Prediction of the court's decisions is a highly dangerous art. As Jesse Choper has said, he who lives by the crystal ball must be prepared to eat ground glass. So with my portion of ground glass at hand, I'll hazard a prediction. I think the court will devise a test along the lines of that third option. Speech of public concern is not protected when it is intended to inflict emotional distress upon a private figure, actually does so, and there is no reasonable connection between the public issues raised by the speech and the target of the speech. We'll see what the court does.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUS Cast. For more episodes of SCOTUS Cast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia.